Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 1 Kings chapter 20, and I'm going to talk about Ahab's war with Ben-Hadad II of Aram, Syria. Our context is this. We've left Elijah, who has fled from the cave on Mount Sinai, heading back up towards Syria, to anoint Elisha as his successor prophet, and the story breaks off there. And so now we switch back to Ahab, the prophet with whom Elijah has had so many dealings. Remember in the last chapter, he had the big contest, or two chapters ago, we had the big contest with the prophets of Baal up at Mount Carmel, defeating them when he called down fire from heaven and burned up the sacrifice on Yahweh's altar and not on Baal's altar. So we begin now in 1 Kings 20, verses 1 through 4. Now Ben-Hadad, this is Ben-Hadad II, he reigned from 860 to 841 B.C., Now Ben-Hadad II, king of Aram, gathered all his army, and there were 32 kings with him, and horses and chariots. And he went up, that's Ben-Hadad II, went up and besieged Samaria. Samaria is the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel, Jezreel, where we left off the story with Ahab and Jezebel. That was their summer palace up there in the Esdraelon Valley. Samaria is back down further south, right in the middle of the tribe of Ephraim. So Ben-Hadad II went up and besieged Samaria and fought against it. Then he sent messengers to the city to Ahab. Now Ahab ruled from 874 to 853. So you can see that Ahab began to reign 14 years earlier than Ben-Hadad. And Ahab died 12 years before Ben-Hadad II did. So their reigns are roughly contemporaneous. Then Ben-Hadad sent messengers to the city to Samaria to Ahab, king of Israel, and said to him, Thus says Ben-Hadad, Your silver and your gold are mine. Your most beautiful wives and children are also mine. The king of Israel replied, It is according to your word, my lord, O king. I am yours and all that I have. Well, that was a nice response because Ahab was besieged and in trouble. Now, this Ben-Hadad II needs to be distinguished from Ben-Hadad I, who was his father. Ben-Hadad I was appealed to by Asa, the southern king of Judah, when Asa wanted to fight Baasha. We read that in 1 Kings 15:18. Asa withdrew all the silver and gold that remained in the treasuries of the Lord's temple and the treasuries of the royal palace and put it into the hands of his servants. Then King Asa sent them to Ben-Hadad. That's Ben-Hadad I. The text doesn't say it. You have to get outside scholars to tell you which Ben-Hadad we're talking about here. Ben-Hadad I ruled from 885 to 860. His son took over in 860. And Ben-Hadad I was the son of Tobrimmon, who ruled from 930 to 885. And Tobrimmon was the son of Hezion, also known as Rezon, who ruled from 990 to 930. And that Rezon is the guy that gave, the Syrian that gave Solomon trouble when Solomon turned to idolatry. So there's a brief genealogy of the kings of Syria. Now Ben-Hadad II had 32 kings with him. The Syrian cities were all independent of each other, so they had separate kings, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. So they were basically little kinglets, if we can put it that way. They besieged Samaria, and that siege happened between 860, because that's when Ben-Hadad II started ruling in 860, and it was somewhere before 853, because Ahab died in 853. So somewhere in that seven-year period, we have a siege of Samaria. Now, what moved Ben-Hadad II to besiege Samaria is not said in the text and cannot be said with precision. Maybe he just had an ambitious view of enlarging his dominions. He wanted to go on a land grab expedition. Well, for whatever reason that Ben-Hadad II attacked Ahab, in God's reasoning, for God's purposes, through the providence of God, the attack was meant to be a scourge to Ahab for Ahab's impiety and idolatry. Now in verse 3, Ben-Hadad II very cockily says, Your gold and silver are mine, your most beautiful wives, and your children are also mine. Now, some people have speculated that the reason that the children are said to be Ben-Hadad's children is because Ben-Hadad wanted to include male children for homosexual purposes, since it doesn't say daughters. Well, that's a stretch, if in my humble opinion. The point is that Ben-Hadad is asking for everything. He wants the whole city. Now, we're going to see later that Ahab is assuming that Ben-Hadad II here is just asking for tribute, which is typical in siege warfare. You pay gold and silver, and the siege ends. And then you give your wives and your children to the besieger for hostages for a security to see that the tribute is actually paid. If the besieged city doesn't pay the tribute, then the besieger takes the wives and children and kills them or mistreats them. So Ahab here is not assuming that he's going to deliver all his wealth and family to Ben-Hadad II. He immediately complied with the king's, Ben-Hadad II's, demands because he was hoping to get more favorable terms. More probably, that's what he's aiming at here. He doesn't get them, as we'll see. We go to 1 Kings 20, verses 5 through 8. Then the messengers returned and said, "Thus says Ben-Hadad." These are Ahab's messengers returning from the camp of Ben-Hadad. The messenger returned and said, "Thus says Ben-Hadad, surely I sent to you, saying, you shall give me your silver and your gold and your wives and your children. But about this time tomorrow I will send my servants to you, and they will search your house and the houses of your servants, and whatever is desirable in your eyes they will take in their hand and carry away." So the messengers bring back bad news to Ahab. He's going to pillage the city. Verse 7. Then the king of Israel, that's Ahab, called all the elders of the land and said, "Please observe and see how this man is looking for trouble, for he sent to me for my wives and my children and my silver and my gold, and I did not refuse him." Ahab saying, look, I was willing to pay him off and give my family for hostages, but now look what he responds with, Ben-Hadad. It's unreasonable. Verse 8, all the elders and all the people said to him, "Do not listen or consent." And I think that was probably fairly reasonable. It's a hard situation. Well, Ben-Hadad told the messengers in verse 5, look, I sent to you, Ahab, saying, give me your silver and gold and your wives. I'm not looking for tribute. His message was not designed at merely asking for tribute. And we see that because the second message is more demanding than the first. I'm going to come into the city. I'm going to burn the place down. I'm going to go house to house. He didn't say burn the place down. He said, I'm going to go house to house. So Ahab misinterpreted the message. Now, it was probably a wise move, as I just said, on Ahab's part to refuse Ben-Hadad's demand for his wives and children and gold and silver. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says that Ahab is so weak he may have even given in to that second demand, but for the objections of his nobles. Maybe so. Interesting speculation. So we go now to 1 Kings 20, 9 through 12. So Ahab said to Ben-Hadad's messengers, "Say to my lord the king, everything you demanded of your servant the first time I will do." In other words, I'll give you gold and silver, my wives and children, but this thing I cannot do. In other words, I'm not going to let you come in here and search house to house and pillage the city. Of course, Ahab's talking real brave here. It was actually his nobles' decisions who backed him up. I'm not going to fault Ahab for that. So the messengers left and took word back to him. Ben-Hadad's messengers took words back to Ben-Hadad. Then Ben-Hadad sent messengers to Ahab and said, "May the gods punish me and do so severely if Samaria's dust amounts to a handful for each of the people who follow me." Let's stop and interpret that little saying there. Actually, there's a couple of ways you can take Ben-Hadad's words. Here's the first option. Ben-Hadad II is saying that so many people would follow Ben-Hadad that if each of them took only a handful of dust from Samaria, they would end up using up all of Samaria. Or you could read it this way. Ben-Hadad says this, "I shall bring such an army in here, there will scarcely be room for them to stand in Samaria and its vicinity, because each Syrian soldier will stand on a handful of Samarian dust, and the place is going to be packed, therefore, with Syrian soldiers." Verse 11, the king of Israel, Ahab, answered, "Say this, don't let the one who puts on his armor boast like the one who takes it off." Well, that's a proverb. The meaning is, don't boast about the triumph before the victory. In other words, one who puts his armor on has not won yet. The one who takes it off has won. Well, Ben-Hadad, my friend, you have not taken your armor off yet because you haven't won yet. Pretty brave words. Verse 12, when Ben-Hadad heard this response, while he and the kings were drinking in the tents, he said to his servants, "Take your positions." So they took their positions against the city. So Ben-Hadad's having a drinking party in the tents of the 32 kings that were allied with him, the kinglets. And so he says, let's besiege the city. We've been refused. Now, this is some time to be drinking. Noon, midday. How do we know it's noon? Because verse 16 says they went out at noon in order to attack the city. but Ben-Hadad was drinking himself drunk in the pavilions. A bunch of drunks, that's what the Syrians were. They had a huge numerical advantage, and they're going to end up losing this siege. We go to 1 Kings 20, verses 13 through 18. Now behold, a prophet approached Ahab, king of Israel, and said, Thus says the Lord, Have you seen all this great multitude? Behold, I will deliver them into your hand today, and you shall know that I am the Lord. Ahab said, By whom? So he, the prophet, said, Thus says the Lord, By the young men of the rulers of the provinces. Then Ahab said, Who shall begin the battle? And the prophet answered, You. Then Ahab mustered the young men of the rulers of the provinces, and they were 232. And after them he mustered all the people, even all the sons of Israel, 7,000. They went out at noon while Ben-Hadad was drinking himself drunk in the temporary shelters with the 32 kings who helped him. The young men of the rulers of the provinces went out first, and Ben-Hadad sent out, and they told him, saying, Men have come out from Samaria. Ben-Hadad sent out, and his messengers came back and told him, Men have come out from Samaria. Then Ben-Hadad said, If they have come out for peace, take them alive, or if they have come out for war, take them alive. Now, who this prophet was who came to Ahab in verse 13 is not named. He could be Micaiah or Micaiah, the son of Imlah, who, of course, was one of Elijah's disciples. Could have been one of those prophets that Obadiah did in the cave at the time of Ahab and Jezebel, you recall, hiding the prophets from Jezebel. Could have been Elijah or Elisha in disguise. The reasoning for that would be it would be strange on just such an occasion, such a momentous occasion as this, not to hear anything of Elijah or Elisha. Yeah, but on the other hand, why wouldn't they be named? So I'm going to just assume this is an unnamed prophet. And the first thing he does is ask a rhetorical question, posing it as from the Lord. Have you seen all this great multitude, Ahab? In other words, you are really outnumbered, son. You are in deep doo-doo. Well, it doesn't matter because I'm going to deliver them into your hand so that you will know that I am the Lord, as opposed to Baal that you're worshiping. Ahab responds to the prophet, By whom? By whom are you going to deliver me from all this multitude? The prophet says, By the young men of the rulers of the provinces. Who are these young men of the rulers of the provinces? Well, it's a little bit unclear. I'm going to give you several options. They could have been sons of governors of the provinces who were held by Ahab for good behavior. And so they were there in Samaria. Ahab not trusting his governmental officials, saying, You better obey me or I'm going to do something bad to your sons. They could have been young men who were actually Ahab's age, having been brought up with him. They could have been servants of princes who waited on Ahab or rulers who waited on Ahab who lived delicately and at ease, not trained for war. So God is picking something weak in the natural to show his glory. Adam Clark speculates they could have been the king's bodyguards there in Samaria. The Cambridge commentator says that, quote, they were probably chieftains who had come from various parts of the kingdom of Israel. The young men would be their attendants or squires. Evidently, they are selected as persons who had no great experience, though they might have the courage to go few in number against a much superior force. So the young men of the rulers, so you distinguish the rulers, those are the governmental officials in the provinces most probably, and then they had attendants and servants, and those were the young men. So then Ahab says to the prophet, Who will begin the battle? The prophet says, You are going to begin the battle. That might seem a strange question. Who else but Ahab would start the battle? Well, I don't think it's a strange question. Ahab could have waited until Ben-Hadad II started the siege. He could have taken the defensive. Very often in ancient warfare, cities won siege battles because the army besieging them ran out of food and water before the food and water ran out in the city. This is especially true if the besieging army did not have siege engines. I don't know if Ben-Hadad II has siege engines or not. But the prophet instructs Ahab, You start the war. Ahab might have thought, Hey, you mean Yahweh is going to let me start the battle? I'm an idolater. I serve Baal. Now, the 232 young men of the rulers of the provinces had 7,000 men of Israel go with them to fight. Now, some people say that these are the same 7,000 who are said not to have bowed their knee to Baal in chapter 18, I think it was. And some people say it's just a coincidence. I believe John Gill says that, and I believe he's right. It's just a coincidence. There's 7,000 there. They're not necessarily all Yahweh worshipers. Verse 17 says, The young men of the rulers of the provinces went out first. ahead of the king, Ahab. Ahab did not lead. Now, as they went out, of course, they're attacking Syrians in their tents who are drinking themselves drunk. Big advantage. So these 232 men came out first. Ben-Hadad had sent scouts out to see what's happening, and they said, we've got some men coming out from Samaria, and so Ben-Hadad says, take them alive. Why did he say that? It's contrary to the law of nations to take messengers prisoner. I don't know whether these 232 men could be considered messengers. They weren't really attacking, but again, that's a lot of people for just being messengers, so I don't think we can fault Ben-Hadad for taking them. Why did he take them alive instead of just killing them on the spot? That would be so he could examine them, question them, and know the state of things in Samaria. He could find out what Ahab intended to do. Well, Ben-Hadad said, take them alive. Well, that never happened, as we'll see, because Ben-Hadad got whomped in the battle. We go now to 1 Kings 20, verses 19 through 22. The young men of the provincial leaders and the army, that's 7,232 people, marched out from the city. So the young men came first, but they couldn't be taken alive because they were backed up by the 7,000 men behind them. Verse 20, and each one struck down his opponent. That means killed them, as the NASB has. So if each Israelite killed one Syrian, then 7,232 Syrians were killed. I don't know if we're going to be that precise 101 when it says in verse 20, each one struck down his opponent. John Gill thinks so. Well, that sounds a little wooden to me. So the Arameans fled, and Israel pursued them, but Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, escaped on a horse with the cavalry. Then the king of Israel, that's Ahab, marched out and attacked the cavalry and the chariots. He inflicted a great slaughter on Aram. Now, Ahab doesn't seem all that brave to me, waiting until the battle was won and then going out and chasing them in the rear. Verse 22, the prophet approached the king of Israel and said to him, go and strengthen yourself. Then consider what you should do, for in the spring the king of Aram will march against you. So after the great battle was won, a prophet tells Ahab, you've won the battle, but you have not won the war, because we are now fighting before wintertime and after wintertime. When spring comes again, they're going to come back after you. Spring was the usual time to start military campaigns. In fact, it says so in 2 Samuel 11:1. Then it happened in the spring at the time when kings go out to battle. Well, that's true of all ancient warfare. Notice after Ahab inflicts a great slaughter on Ben-Hadad II, there were no sacrifices to God as thanksgiving, which is typically done. And that's probably because Ahab was an idolater who worshipped Baal. It doesn't say one way or the other, so that's a speculation. It's an argument from silence, but I would think that if he had offered up a sacrifice to God, it would have been recorded here, but it wasn't. The prophet tells Ahab, consider what you're going to do, because Ben-Hadad II is coming back next spring. And what he meant was, consider what you can do or what you're going to do religiously as well as militarily. You've just seen that Yahweh won this battle. The prophet came to you and said, so that you may know Yahweh, I'm going to beat this great multitude. Well, Yahweh did it. So maybe you ought to consider who you should worship now. We go to 1 Kings 20, verses 23 through 25. Now the servants of the king of Aram said to him, their gods, the Israelites' gods, are gods of the mountains. Therefore they were stronger than we. But rather, let us fight against them in the plain, and surely we will be stronger than they. Do this thing. Remove the kings, each from his place. That's the 32 kinglets of Syria. Remove those kings, say Ben-Hadad II's counselors. Remove those kings, each from his place, and put captains in their place, and muster an army like the army that you have lost, horse for horse and chariot for chariot. Then we will fight against them in the plain, and surely we will be stronger than they. And he, Ben-Hadad II, listened to their voice, his counselor's voice, and did so. So during the off-season, during the winter, Ahab reconstitutes his army, gets rid of the cowardly kings who ran, puts captains, that means military people, in the place of the kings, replaces his lost horses and chariots, and he's good to go again. Change of strategy, though. We're going to fight the Israelites on the plains, not on the mountains. Well, why did the Syrians think that the Israelites' gods were gods of the mountains? Well, all through the Old Testament, good things happen on mountains. For example, the law was given at Mount Sinai. God beat the prophets of Baal at Carmel, which we just read about a couple of chapters ago. Israel's idolatrous worship, as well as some Yahweh worship, was done on high places, on those altars on the mountains, on the hills. The temple at Jerusalem was on a high hill, Mount Moriah. Now, it's true the southern Israelites were now politically disconnected from the northern Israelites that the Syrians are fighting, but there could still be a connection in the Syrian mind. You know, these Israelites, they're always up on high places. It was a very common thing for pagans to associate deities with particular topological places like hills, mountains, rivers, woods, and valleys. They were idols or god, not idols, but gods in all of these places. So this might sound strange to us, but it's not strange to a ancient pagan to think that the Israelites don't have a god who could fight in the plains. They didn't understand that Yahweh was omnipresent. That was something new to their pagan minds. Why did Ben-Hadad II remove the kings and put military captains in their place? Gill and Clark say it's because the kings, being kings, were delicate, not fit for war. They sat around with robes all day and ate fancy food. Also, Ben-Hadad II was using allies, tributaries, and tributaries aren't going to fight as hard as someone will fight for themselves. This is John Gill's idea, and so Ben-Hadad II got his own people in there that are going to fight for Ben-Hadad II, not for themselves. And plus, the kings were removed because they'd already been beaten before in the last battle. Time to shake up the army. Now, by fighting on the plain, not only is there a religious reason for that, but also, as John Gill says, there's a natural reason. The Syrians would be able to use their chariots to greater advantage. Now, so would the Israelites, but the Arameans, the Syrians, had a much larger army, so their advantage would be leveraged on the plains there. They had more chariots, so they would have a bigger advantage. So we go now to 1 Kings 20, verses 26 through 27. At the turn of the year, springtime, Ben-Hadad mustered the Arameans and went up to Aphek to fight against Israel. The sons of Israel were mustered and were provisioned and went to meet them, and the sons of Israel camped before them like two little flocks of goats, but the Arameans filled the country. All right, this battle at Aphek is the second battle against Ben-Hadad II, the first being before the winter time, the previous battle, which was the siege of Samaria. Ben-Hadad had lost that, and now we're at Aphek. Now, the question is where is Aphek? Well, I don't think anybody really knows. Easton's gives three definitions of Aphek, or three places that Aphek could be. Aphek means stronghold, and so there's lots of places called stronghold. I'm going to skip two of them and mention the one that he thinks is the battle that took place here with Ben-Hadad II, a town on the road from Damascus to Palestine in the level plain east of Jordan. Well, that makes sense, because between Israel and Damascus, there's a desert there. It's flat, and that could be a good place where the battle was fought. Gill and Jameson Foster and Brown disagree with that. BibleAtlas.org has three Apheks. Two of them have question marks by them. The one that is certain that does not have a question mark by it is at the head of the Arkon River, which is nowhere near Damascus and the plain between northeastern Israel and Damascus. They don't have an Aphek at all that lines up with Easton's on the plain between Damascus and Palestine. So my conclusion is that nobody really knows where Aphek was, but Easton's number three definition, somewhere outside of Damascus on the way to Israel, is probably where this battle took place. So in verse 27, the sons of Israel were mustered. I guess we can assume it's the same 232 young men and the 7,000 men who came before. I don't know that. Gill says it's true. But at any rate, they're still outnumbered. And the picture here is of Israel as two little flocks of goats, contrasting to Arameans who filled the countryside. Horizon to horizon, nothing but Syrian soldiers. Once again, the side that God wanted to win was outnumbered mightily. We go now to 1 Kings 28 through 31. Then a man of God came near and spoke to the king of Israel and said, "Thus says the Lord, because the Arameans have said, 'The Lord is a God of the mountains, but he is not a God of the valleys,' therefore I will give all this great multitude in your hand, and you shall know that I am the Lord." In other words, the prophet said, we're going to disabuse the Syrians of the notion that it matters where you fight the God of Israel, Yahweh. It doesn't matter because he's everywhere. He can win in the plains just as well as he can win in the mountains, on the mountain of Samaria, on the tableland of Samaria. He won there. He won up high, and he's going to win down low here in the plain. Verse 29, so they, that means the men of Israel and the men of Syria, camped one over against the other 7 days. And on the seventh day, the battle was joined, and the sons of Israel killed of the Arameans 100,000 foot soldiers in one day, a huge slaughter. But the rest fled to Aphek into the city, and the wall fell on 27,000 men who were left. And Ben-Hadad fled and came into the city into an inner chamber. So this was a huge defeat for the Syrians. Small army, two little goat army, the army that looked like two little goats, wiped them out. I'd be curious to know how they did it, but we were not told. Ben-Hadad fled and came into the city, came into Aphek, into an inner chamber. His servants said to him, "Behold now, we have heard that the kings of the house of Israel are merciful kings. Please let us put sackcloth on our loins and ropes on our heads or around our heads and go out to the king of Israel. Perhaps he will save your life." Now this man of God, the prophet who told Ahab, "You shall know that I am the Lord after your army wins this great battle." Well, Ahab doesn't seem to know that it was God who won the battle. He doesn't appear thankful to God for the victory. He doesn't appear to be reformed from his idolatry. And we'll see later on, he still acts like a crud bum. But basically what the prophet is saying, God's going to show his honor here and his glory here, whether you receive it or not, Ahab. Now this 100,000, you know, a lot of times in the Old Testament, you're suspicious of the numbers because of textual problems. But as Adam Clark says here, there are no variant reasons. They all said 100,000. Of course, that's a round number. How did the wall fall on the 27,000 who were left? Another round number. The people, the soldiers of Ben-Hadad who were in the city of Aphek, and the wall fell on them. God could have supernaturally done that with a wind or an earthquake. The Israelites may have sapped the walls and dug tunnels under the walls to make them fall. It could be the Syrians standing on the wall to fight the Israelites and their weight destroyed the wall. I tend to not think that's what happened. Doesn't matter. The wall fell. The bad guys died. Now, in Aphek, Ben-Hadad II had fled to an inner room that was to hide from the victorious Israelites. He knew he couldn't stay there forever. He couldn't go outside the wall. There was no wall to protect him anymore. The Israelites were there, so he was stuck. So he's facing death. His servants, his counselors said, "Look, we need to plead for mercy here to the Israelites. We've heard they are merciful." How did the Syrians hear that? I don't know. The reputation, I guess, had gone around that the Israelites were easy on their enemies. As Benson said, the Hebrew religion had taught the Israelites humanity and obliged them to show mercy. Sometimes they tore the city down outside of Canaan, but once they were in Canaan, they typically did not pillage the cities and wipe out the women and children. So the Syrians are hoping here for some mercy. So they came out, sackcloth on their ashes, that's a symbol of penitence and humility, and ropes, and the NASB says ropes on their head, ropes on their heads. Holman Christian Study Bible says ropes around their heads. All the commentators say it's around ropes around the neck to show their subjugation. Cambridge commentator says that, for example. So Ben-Hadad II has come a long way from haughtily threatening destruction of Israel. Now he's walking around in sackcloth with a rope around his neck. We go now to 1 Kings 20, verses 32 through 34. So they, that's the Syrians, girded sackcloth on their loins and put ropes around their heads and came to the king of Israel and said, "Your servant Ben-Hadad says, please let me live." And he said, "Is he still alive? He is my brother." Now that word brother means something here. Verse 33, now the men, that's the Syrians, took this as an omen. Oh, he called our king a brother. Maybe he's not going to kill us. And quickly catching his word, said, "Your brother Ben-Hadad." They said, yes. Our king is your brother, Ahab, your brother. Then Ahab said, go bring Ben-Hadad to me. Then Ben-Hadad came out to Ahab, and Ahab took Ben-Hadad up into the chariot. Ben-Hadad said to him, "The cities which my father took from your father I will restore, and you shall make streets for yourself in Damascus, as my father made in Samaria." Ahab said, "And I will let you go with this covenant." So he made a covenant with him and let him go. So Ahab strikes a deal with Ben-Hadad. I'm going to get into the weeds here in just a minute about verse 34, textual problem, but just basically, no matter how we solve that problem, we see here that peace has been made between Ahab and Ben-Hadad, and Ahab does not execute Ben-Hadad II. So here's the textual problem. Verse 34, the NASB and almost every other translation I looked at says, Ben-Hadad said to him, meaning Ben-Hadad said to Ahab. However, the Young's Literal Translation points out that Ben-Hadad is not in the original Hebrew. And so the Young's Literal Translation has, he said to him. So it either could be Ben-Hadad said to Ahab, or Ahab said to Ben-Hadad. It's not clear. Well, if we take it in the way that most of the translations take it, Ben-Hadad said to Ahab, this is what Ben-Hadad is saying. The cities which my father, Ben-Hadad the first, took from your father Omri, I will restore. In other words, Ben-Hadad the second has taken some cities from you, Israel. I'll give those cities back. And you, Ahab, shall make streets for yourself in Damascus. And what that means is you'll have trading concessions in Damascus. You'll have marketplaces. We'll let you trade in Damascus. Just as my father, Ben-Hadad the second, was given trading concessions in Samaria. That makes a lot of sense. That's the easiest way to look at it. Adam Clark and Jameson Foster and Brown take it that way. John Gill, on the other hand, says it's Ahab speaking here. I'm not going to go through his logic. I don't think it makes any sense, not to me anyway. And most of the translations agree that Ben-Hadad is speaking. So from this we can deduce that Israel had been oppressed by Ben-Hadad the first. Ben-Hadad the first had taken some cities from the northern kingdom of Israel. And now Ben-Hadad the second is going to give them back because he just got whipped at Aphek by Ahab. And then as a part of the treaty of defeat here, Ben-Hadad says, I'm going to give you, Ahab, trading concessions so you can trade in Damascus. Just as when my father was whipping up on you, you gave him trading concessions in Samaria. Ahab said, okay, I'll let you go with this covenant, this deal. They made the covenant, and Ahab let him go. Big mistake to let him go. We go to 1 Kings 20, 35 through 36. Now a certain man of the sons of the prophets said to another by the word of the Lord, please strike me. But the man refused to strike him. Then he said, because you have not listened to the voice of the Lord, behold, as soon as you have departed from me, a lion will kill you. As soon as he had departed from him, a lion found him and killed him. Now who this prophet was, again, speculation, Gill and Josephus say it's Micaiah, that's Elijah's disciple, because he had been with Ahab more than once. I don't think it's profitable to even speculate about that. It doesn't matter. He asked another prophet to strike him, and that other prophet refused to do so. Now, why did the other prophet refuse to strike this first prophet? Maybe he was a neighbor. He didn't want to strike his neighbor. Maybe he was a fellow prophet. Doesn't really say he's another prophet, but it implies that. So a certain man of the sons of the prophet said to another, there's nothing after another, to another prophet maybe, to another man. But whoever it was, maybe he had affection for the prophet. But for whatever reason, he didn't strike him. Now, as a result of that, he was punished. He was killed by a lion. Now, that's an extreme punishment for an act of kindness. Why? Well, it could be because there are high requirements. If a prophet tells you something, you better obey him. Remember the prophet who was supposed to go up to prophesy against Jeroboam the first, and he was told to get up there and then come right back, and then another prophet talked him out of it and said, come eat something with me and come on back up here to Bethel. And as a result, a lion ate that prophet. You mess it around with the word of God, you better be real careful, because just like Nadab and Abihu found out when they messed around with the sacrifice in the Levitical worship, they got blasted by fire. You don't mess around with God. So this man disobeyed the word of God, and he died because of it. So we go now to 1 Kings 20, verses 37 through 43. Then he found another man, that's the prophet, found another man and said, please strike me. And the man struck him, wounding him. So the prophet departed and waited for the king, by the way, that's King Ahab, and disguised himself with a bandage over his eyes. As the king passed by, he cried to the king and said, your servant went out into the midst of the battle. And behold, a man turned aside and brought a man to me and said, guard this man. If for any reason he is missing, then your life shall be for his life, or else you shall pay a talent of silver. Now, why would a soldier want to have a POW taken care of so carefully? It's because these prisoners were routinely ransomed. Relatives would pay for them to get them out of slavery. And so a prisoner is worth something. And so in this fake story that the prophet is telling, he's saying a soldier had a POW and he was tasked with taking care of that POW. The prophet was. Verse 40. While your servant, the prophet continues to speak, while your servant was busy here and there, he was gone, the POW was gone. And the king of Israel said to him, so shall your judgment be, you yourself have decided it. Then he, the prophet, hastily took the bandage away from his eyes, and the king of Israel recognized that he was one of the prophets. The prophet said to Ahab, "Thus says the Lord, because you have let go out of your hand the man whom I have devoted to destruction, therefore your life shall go for his life, and your people for his people." So the king of Israel went to his house sullen and vexed, and came to Samaria. Going back to verse 37, the prophet found another man and asked him to strike him, please. One has to wonder whether the first man's death by a lion might have had some influence on the second man, who said, "Oh yeah, I'll strike you, no problem." And the strike, the blow, was strong enough to wound the prophet, to make him obviously wounded so people could see that he was wounded. So this prophet, dressed up like a wounded soldier, waited for the king. By the way, this is as Ahab is coming back from Aphek to his capital city of Samaria. Put a bandage over his eyes. The King James has ashes. That makes no sense. You can't disguise yourself with ashes. Adam Clark said that bandage is the original reading, and that's pretty evident. So a bandage is over his eyes. Now, the soldier in the story, the fake soldier, said that you guard my POW, and if you let him go, you're either going to have to pay me 75 talents or you're going to have to die. The problem with 75 talents of silver, that's so much, there's no way an ordinary soldier is going to have that kind of money. It's about 75 pounds of silver, as the NIV footnote says. So basically, this fake wounded soldier is telling Ahab, "I'm a dead man. I let my prisoner get away, and I'm going to get killed for it." Now, this, of course, is a perfect object lesson, because Ahab let his prisoner get away, and he's going to die for it. Ahab spoke the judgment right out of his own mouth. He says to the prophet, "So shall your judgment be. You yourself have decided it. You agreed to keep the POW, and if you let him go, you're going to die. Well, you've just spoken your own judgment." And Ahab says, "Yep, Ahab, and so have you." Now, when the prophet took his bandage off, Ahab immediately recognized that he was one of the prophets. Why? Because Ahab had seen him before. There was no other way for Ahab to recognize that he was a prophet except that he had seen him from before. And he's probably thinking, "Oh my gosh, another one of these pesky prophets from Yahweh. I wonder what bad news he's going to deliver to me." Well, the bad news was, your life shall go for Ben-Hadad II's life. You're going to die because Ben-Hadad II didn't die. And your people, the northern Israelites, are going to die because you didn't kill the Syrians. Now, did that happen? Absolutely. The prophet's words were fulfilled. We're going to see that Ahab is eventually killed by a Syrian soldier, and so then his life was given for Ben-Hadad's life. We read in 1 Kings 22, verses 34 and 35, that a Syrian soldier eventually killed Ahab. Now, a certain man drew his bow at random and struck the king of Israel in a joint of the armor. So he said to the driver of his chariot, Ahab did, "Turn around and take me out of the fight, for I am severely wounded." The battle raged that day, and the king was propped up in his chariot in front of the Arameans and died at evening, and the blood from the wound ran into the bottom of the chariot. That was at the Battle of Ramoth-Gilead. Ahab is killed by a Syrian. So this prophet with the bandage on his head gave a word that was perfectly fulfilled. Ahab gave his life because he did not wipe out the Syrians when he had the chance, and the Syrian ended up killing him. Not only was Ahab's life going to be given according to the prophet, but also Ahab's people were going to be given for the Syrian people. The Syrian people were going to wipe out Ahab's people, even as a Syrian soldier wiped out Ahab's life. When were the people of Israel beaten by Assyria? Well, we see that Hazael, king of Syria, is going to do that later on in his reign, which was from 841 to 801, 2 Kings 8:12, Hazael said, "Why does my lord Elisha weep?" Then Elisha answered, "Because I know the evil that you will do to the sons of Israel. Their strongholds you will set on fire, and their young men you will kill with a sword, and their little ones you will dash in pieces, and their women with child you will rip up." And we see in 2 Kings 10:32, "In those days the Lord began to cut off portions from Israel, and Hazael defeated them throughout the territory of Israel." This happened after the death of Ahab, mostly during the reign of Jehu, who reigned from 841 to 814. His reign started at the same time as Hazael of Syria's reign started. Jehu died 13 years before Hazael did, but it's roughly contemporaneous. So the people of Israel suffered because Syria was not wiped out when Ahab had the chance to wipe them out. Well, verse 43, the king of Israel, Ahab, goes to his house sullen and vexed. This unnamed prophet had taken all the joy out of Ahab's victory at Aphek. But Ahab should have fought this. Maybe instead of being displeased with the prophet, maybe you should have been displeased with yourself, Ahab. If you'd have done what the prophet had said, then maybe the prophet's predictions might not have come true. Now that brings up an interesting question. I don't think anywhere the prophet had actually said or God had actually told Ahab to wipe out Ben-Hadad II. The prophet says that God has devoted Syria to destruction, but I don't see where, at least unless I missed it, I don't see where any prophet ever told Ahab Syria is devoted for destruction. Maybe it was just understood, or maybe God is rebuking Ahab from being stupid rather than being disobedient to an explicit word of God. At any rate, a beautiful victory over the Syrians should have led to rejoicing and happiness. Instead, it leads to a very disgusted and depressed King Ahab. So now we are finished with chapter 20. We are prepared now to go in our next audio to chapter 21, verses 1 through 29, and we'll look at the sad, sad story of Naboth's vineyard that Ahab stole. We'll see you in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.